Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at home improvement on the show today and focusing on what pre-planning you should do when starting a home remodel with our guest John Freiberger back with us. John's a Wisconsin registered home inspector, more than 40 years of home improvement experience. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What home improvement questions do you have? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. John Freiberger, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Pleased to be back, Larry.
Before we talk about planning for a remodel, what are some of the common mistakes people make when taking that project on before they even take it on?
Well, it's the failure to pre-plan.
Yeah.
To really get yourself organized. And you can waste a lot of money, and you can put an addition on your house that just doesn't function very well. You can put an addition on your house that makes sort of a mess of your existing house. So a lot of thought has to go into it. And the problems that I see are of two types. One is contractor error. The guys my age have all retired.
Mm-hmm.
And we seem to be very, very short of people who are going into the trades. I mean, hopefully that is beginning to change, because going into the trades nowadays pays very, very well.
Yeah.
And we're seeing a push for young people to go, well, I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to go to trade school. And in 2 years, I'm going to have an associate degree, and I'm going to be a journeyman carpenter, and I'm not going to have any debt. And I'm going to have a good life ahead of me and retire at 55, which is what most carpenters seem to be able to do. So the mistakes that we have with simply assembling the cabinets or putting crooked. I've got a new house, Larry. If you put a level on the doors, there's an inch and a half gap between the top and the bottom of the door. I mean, how do you hang a door that crooked? So those sorts of things happen. But those are all very fixable. I mean, take the door out and you do a little bit of work and you put it back in and it's just fine. The problems that where we really see difficulties are where people have not done the design work so that the house is going to survive Wisconsin's climate. Now, we're getting a good lesson in climate right now, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
I mean, it's 80 degrees. It's 30 degrees above normal right now. And the winter sometimes is 30 degrees below normal. And we have all this humidity in our house. And Wisconsin swings wildly, which means the humidity inside our wall structure swings wildly. And if we have vapor barrier systems that aren't working, air barrier systems that aren't working, insulation that isn't really working, we could have a really beautiful home where all the doors are square and all the cabinets are perfect and the walls are rotting. And that's one of the areas that I've really been focusing on lately, because that stuff, unlike the crooked door, is not easy to fix.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes you're not even aware of it.
That's exactly right, Larry, and that is the big problem. By the time you see some staining under a window and you go, well, is that window leaking? Oh, no, actually it's condensation in the wall and your studs are rotted. And suddenly you're literally replacing framing in a house that's 20, 30 years old. So it can really be a problem. So the other thing is that, yeah, I keep looking at my gas bill and my electrical bill, and boy, things are not as inexpensive as they used to be. So we start looking at the cost of heating and cooling houses where we do not have a good thermal envelope and a good wind barrier, good vapor barrier. We're spending a lot of money perhaps maintaining a house that is, to a certain extent, unmaintainable because the Wisconsin climate is literally eating away at its bones.
So what do you do? How do you resolve?
Well, you do a little bit of thinking. And what I'm talking to people about more and more, we used to talk about insulation. I'm talking about outsolation. Our big problem in Wisconsin, especially in the winter, is condensation. Now, leaks on the outside, that's a problem. pretty easy to solve, right?
Mm-hmm.
We put on a good roof. We make sure that we've got our weather-resistant barrier on the exterior and make sure we have good quality windows that are actually installed correctly, which means about half of them. And we can keep the outside water from getting into the walls. The big problem that we seem to have right now is inside water. For example, Larry, I got called by a gentleman, and he wanted to sue his insulation contractor. Mm. He had a house with an addition, and the addition was okay. The original house had very little insulation. So he had a guy come in and blow in a whole lot of insulation. And 6 months later, he went up looking in his attic, and everything was green.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to sue the insulation contractor. I said, well, you can't. It's not his fault. But what had happened is he had cooled off his attic enough by adding the insulation that he increased the condensation because the house had no vapor barrier.
No.
So all winter long, right above his kitchen and bathroom and everything else, and, you know, the cat and three dogs breathing, that moisture went up into the attic. But now because the attic was cool rather than warm, the air wasn't really moving. So it condensed out on the what we call the first condensing surface, which is the first thing solid that you hit after the dew point. And that was the roof sheeting. So he ended up having to replace the roof on at least half of his house because he hadn't planned correctly. So when we think about either designing an addition to our house or retrofitting our existing house, we need to look at not just insulation, but we need to control the condensation. So it's retaining the heat and controlling the moisture that we really need to think about. And what I like about outsolation, Larry, is that what we're going to do is we're going to use a material like a foam, which we've all seen, and most yeah. new houses now have at least 1 inch of foam on the outside wall. And what I'm looking at is basically doing 3 inches of foam on outside walls and 4 inches of foam on roofs, and your attic then becomes a warm space. So suddenly we have no condensation problems in the attic. We have no condensation problems in the walls because the temperature is never as low as the dew point, so we are not going to get condensation.
You know, condensation, the attic, the basement. Rick in Madison has a question that kind of relates to this, so let's go there and see what's on Rick's mind. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Sure. Thank you. We had a central air system installed, and so you have the condenser on the outside of the building, but then decided to put the air handler in the attic, and to preserve the ceiling height in the basement, had ductwork put into the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And what we experienced is during the winter, condensation will build up inside the duct tubes. And so for a number of years, we tried completely blocking off. We'd close the ceiling vents and then also put a styrofoam plate over the vent and also the intake. With a styrofoam sheet, trying to completely block off the air going into the tubes. It didn't seem to help at all. I'm not sure why. And in a very kind of counterintuitive move, the last couple winters, we left all of the vents open. And occasionally, if we notice a little moisture dripping from a ceiling vent, we turn on the fan and just let the air blow through for a few mm-hmm. hours. That seems to have solved it. We also suspended the tubes so that it wouldn't collect because literally in the spring we'd have a few gallons of water in the tubes. Is this system just really not built for Wisconsin?
Generally, yes. However, your problem with your attic is cold. So talking about outsolation. So let's say your shingles were shot. You're going to put a new roof on the house. What one could do is take a look at putting energy panels on the roof. Now, they were energy panels Mike Cornell in northern Wisconsin invented them many, many years ago. And I believe he sold his patents to GAF, the shingle people. So if you go to Google GAF, the shingle people, and then look at their energy panels, and what you're going to see is 2, 3, 4, 5 inches of foam bonded to blocking for a 1-inch airspace and then roof sheathing above it. And what we've done, I've done a lot of historic restoration. So people have these nice mid-century modern houses with the big cathedral ceilings, but they've got terrible heat loss. and they don't want to lower the ceiling. So what we started using the Cornell panels, though the name has now changed, and applying them over the top of the existing sheathing and then roofing over the top of that. That gave us the thermal barrier that we needed to not have condensation and things, and maintained also the ceiling height. So that would be one thing to look at, because then at that point you now have a warm attic. Your attic is going to be about the same temperature as the rest of your house. But a lot of places in Wisconsin, you have radiators or fin tube and hot water or steam heat, and you don't necessarily want to use the split packs, the Mitsubishis. Yeah. You don't want them hanging off the wall in your room looking sort of like a motel.
Yeah.
So people put the systems up in the attics. And I can guarantee you that they all leak air. And we've got the air pressure in the house, you know, the thermal pressure is going to work its way up there no matter how carefully you seal them. Now, what you're doing is you're heating them, so you're getting them above the dew point. So we're not getting condensation. And your local utility stockholders thank you for that, that big donation you're making towards them. So I have retrofitted some where we've actually spray foamed the entire ceiling. We basically, not the ceiling, the ducts. We've placed the ducts basically right on the top of the ceiling rafters. And then we spray foamed encapsulating them completely with at least 4 inches of foam. That gets us up to R28. It doesn't get us to R50 where we want to be, but then sometimes we've actually put more insulation over the top of that. But at that point, we've moved the thermal barrier to the top side of the ducts instead of being underneath the ducts, and that works. So you may want to consider something like that. Talk to a spray foam contractor. Depending on how old your house is, Rick, and here again to get back into pre-planning, Larry, is I'm looking at a lot of existing houses and going in the attics and saying, I don't want to add insulation. I want to suck all this insulation out. And then I want to put down 2 inches of spray foam so I have a vapor barrier and an air barrier. And then if I've got ducts or pipes in the attic, I'm going to spray them a little extra heavy. Then I'm just going to put in cheap cellulose. And that way, everything is going to be inside the thermal barrier, and we are not going to get condensation. So you need to probably talk to a contractor, Rick, who understands these things. It could be that it's going to be an insulation contractor that you need to initially speak with. But you're probably losing a lot of money in utility bills right now. Plus, if you've got condensation, you may have mold, you may have other things going on in those ducts that you really don't want to live with.
Yeah. Rick, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Freiberger, our guest today of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home renovation and repair and doing a little pre-planning before you get those home improvement projects going with our guest John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. He has more than 40 years of home improvement experience. Great to have him back. Laura in Arpin has a question for you. John, let's go there. Laura, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Our house is about 15 years old, and we've got a partially finished basement. Last weekend, we literally had water pouring in through one of our egress windows during the thunderstorms. It's the first time this has happened, and so I was sucking the water up in the window as my husband was outside trying to pound a T-post down in the ground to see about getting the water to drain in that deep window well. Mm-hmm. So my question is two parts. Like, I guess, why did it happen? What do we do to prevent it? And then I also wondered, do we need to start a remodel and remove all of the drywall from that wall?
Well, let's do last part first. If that wall was wet for 24 hours, you probably have mold on the backside of the wall. And what you're going to want to do is to call in a certified mold remediation contractor to take a look at it. Now, does your house have a sump pump and a drain tile system?
Yes.
Good. Now, what we've always done basements are wonderful things in Wisconsin because you've got the soil all around it, and they're huge, the size of the house, and it's wasted space. So we always want to put in egress windows and then make that space habitable. So when I was designing houses, I would make sure we had a drain tile system. And then when we got to the egress system, what I would do is have a T down at the footing and come up and basically put a sight drain in the egress window. So that if it flooded, it didn't flood. The water came in, it went down into the drain tile system, went to the sump pump, and the sump pump pumped it outside. Now, your egress window, depending on how deep it is, it might be 3 feet deep, might be 4 foot deep. It could be that you've got 3 feet to dig down to find the drain tile, but that would be a permanent solution.
Oh, so who would you get in for that?
Well... a neighbor boy with a strong back, because this is basically shovel work.
Ah.
It's going to depend upon how deep it is. Obviously, if this is something that's fairly deep, but most Wisconsin basement walls are 8-foot walls.
Yeah.
And if we're down 4 feet, can we dig down 4 feet? Maybe. It's very hard to get in there with many excavators because the window wells are so small. So a lot of times this is hand digging. But if you take some measurements on the inside, if you've got like 27 inches down to your floor, you've maybe got 30 inches down to the drain tile, that isn't too bad. Mm-hmm. You might have to have somebody with a small shovel and 5-gallon buckets and haul it up to the surface and then throw that soil away. And then when you find the drain tile, cut into it, put in a T, put in a drain, and then put washed stone around that drain so that all the water that goes into that egress well is going to go right down to your drain tile. Does that make sense, Laura?
I think so. And does that stay clear, or is there something that we need to do to maintain to make sure it doesn't clog?
It should stay clear. Obviously, you're going to have leaves and things, so I like to have a sight drain. It's the sort of thing that people put in their yards, and it usually has a grill on it so that leaves and things don't get sucked down and end up in your sump pit. But you should be able to see these, find these things online. Any lumber yard is going to have them. So just do a little bit of research. Look up sight drains, look up window well drainage online, and you're going to see some nice little drawings that are going to show you exactly what you want.
Yeah.
But it's a very solvable problem. And the nice thing about the solution is it's permanent.
Yeah, it is. And you can take a look in there now. You've been living there a while. How much collects in there? You probably get an idea. And then take John's advice.
Mm-hmm.
Laura, thank you for calling. Dawn in Saukville, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dawn.
So we're all cleaning out our gutters around the house right now, between the basement, around the edges of the house. I'm just wondering how deep to have the dirt, and then how deep to have the stone around the edge of the house, and then how far out should you have the stone, and then I have a question follow-up after that.
Okay, so you're talking about the washed stone that people use decoratively around their houses?
Yeah, I'd like to keep a small border close to the basement wall.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, what we have to think about first, Dawn, is what is under the stone, because the reason we use that stone is the water goes through it really fast. It's much better than mulch if our siding is close, because that way we're going to keep our siding drier. But what you want to make sure is that your grade drains away from the house. Now, if you're building a new house, the code says it has to be a half inch per foot for 10 feet. In other words, 5 inches of slope. So you don't want to put washed stone on depressed soil around your house, because then you're basically putting a ditch next to your foundation.
Yeah.
So if you have some stone there now, you may want to rake it away, and then design it so that you've got some some drainage, some pitch, right? And then the width of the stone makes no difference really at all. If you use a border, and people have these rubber borders, make sure that your downspouts go past that rubber border. Because otherwise they act like a dam, mm-hmm. and you're dumping the water right next to your house. Did that mm-hmm. answer all of your question, Dawn?
So what should be up against the basement wall, I guess I'm asking? It shouldn't be stone from what you're saying?
No, it can indeed be stone. because the stone drains nicely. It's just that the water is going to go through the stone, and I want to make sure it goes away from the wall. So under the stone, we need soil that is sloped away from the basement wall.
Yeah. Got to be sloped away. There you go, Don. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Katie in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Question. I had an energy audit done on my house several years ago, from which I received a new gas furnace and insulation in the attic. At the time, the guys told me that they put in 3 inches more insulation than they needed. I was supposed to have 4 inches. They put in 7. And he said, I asked what the ramifications were, and he said, well, you might get some moisture on your windows, which we do in extensively throughout the winter. And I'm watching the wood. And I have some Anderson Renew windows that were put in before we moved in. And I'm watching the wood, and it's looking pretty rugged. I wonder what I should do. And I'm worried about the framing. If the windows are looking this way, what's going on behind?
Katie, how old is your house?
It was late 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Brick.
Yep. Sure.
And the windows are new or newer?
The windows have been replaced before we moved in. So they're not the original.
Sure. Okay. So we have a house that that breathes a lot. Moisture moves through everything. And what we probably have is perhaps a slightly higher humidity inside the house than we really want. Do you have a good quality humidistat hung on your wall so you know what your interior humidity is?
No,
okay.
Not at all.
Let's start there. Let's order one online, spend a little money, get something that's accurate, and then let's see what your humidity is. I like to see winter humidity in houses at 40%. Now, some people say, nah, skin gets too dry, I think it's got to be 45%. If we are up at 70% humidity, we can end up, and if it's 20 degrees outside, we can end up with serious condensation on our windows, because the glass, unless it's really, really expensive windows, and yours are probably standard windows, as most people in Wisconsin have, the windows are going to hit the dew point. We can either increase the temperature in the house so that the windows are warmer, but that's expensive, or we can decrease the humidity. So as we decrease the humidity, we are going to get less condensation on the windows. And because you have no vapor barrier on your walls and ceiling, other than paint perhaps, we are going to decrease condensation on the sheathing and in the attic. So the first thing and the cheapest thing to do is simply find out what your humidity is in the house. And if it stays too high, it could be that you need better bathroom exhaust fans. You may need a kitchen hood vented to the outside. So let's start there, because that's very low cost, and see to what extent we can mitigate the problem with very simple solutions.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good idea. John Freiberger, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. And you can join in. Give us an email at ideas@wpr.org/Larry. You can phone us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Mary in Fontana next. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Nice to hear to be on the show, Larry.
Well, thanks for joining us.
I have a question about my home in Fontana. 15 years old, very nice home. We've had it 4 years now. It came with a wonderful radiant floor heating system in the basement and the garage. We like it very much. This winter, we were doing a completely separate remodeling project where the plumber turned the water off to the whole house several times. And we noticed a leak from the hot water heater that was for the radiant floor heating system, called in a service person. He said, oh, this is 15 years old and it's obsolete. You need to replace this with a boiler. By the way, the water leak was actually, it was doing what it was supposed to do. It was just a check valve because the water had been turned off to the whole house. But he told us that the glycol level was low, and just to replace the glycol in the radiant floor heating system was going to be $3,000 to $4,000. And to replace the whole system with a boiler, you're looking at around $20,000. So I've gotten two quotes by now. And I want to know if you think, should we proactively replace this hot water tank with a boiler that then will service all our showers and all our hot water needs and the radiant floor heating system at all? Or should we wait for it to fail? Because I'm afraid with low glycol that it'll freeze up and then it'll be in a lot more difficult situation.
Yeah.
And the two quotes I've gotten are wildly different. One calls for a replacement with 150,000 BTU boiler, and the other one is an 85,000 BTU boiler.
Mm-hmm. Well, 85,000 really gives you a lot of BTU. So this is a binary system where you've got two different loops. One is the floor radiant heat loop with glycol water, and the other one is your domestic hot water, where, of course, you don't want glycol. So basically, you've got one burner, and you've got two heating coils that are heating two different systems. What you have to do is you take a look and you do a heat loss analysis, but of course, heat loss analysis on a garage, well, there's going to be a lot of heat loss. But with a glycol system, you're not heating your garage to 70 degrees, I don't think, unless you've got a big workshop out there or something. So my guess would be that the lower number is probably going to be correct, but somebody should prepare for you some heat loss calculations. Most houses, if you have a good sized storage tank on your domestic hot water, 30 to 40,000 BTUs is plenty. Now, if you're running, everybody's taking a shower in the morning, plus we're trying to heat up the basement, plus heat up the garage, yeah, then we may need 85, but it could be that for most of the time, lower than 85 would work. The glycol is extremely important, and getting glycol into that system so you are not going to freeze till past 25 below zero, I think is the standard in Wisconsin, is very important to do. And beyond that, I don't think we really need the boiler with the binary system. But take a look at energy efficiencies. So take a look at you're probably going to be able to get a water heater that is sealed combustion at least 85%. The boilers, you can get up to 96 to 98% at this point. So take a look at what your 10 years of utility costs are going to be, see what you can get for rebates, et cetera, and consider all of the various factors that you need to think about for both long-term costs and short-term costs and good comfort. And then make a decision. Pre-planning, the theme for today, right?
Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Barb in Milwaukee has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Barb.
Good morning. Last night, I can't believe that you guys are doing this show today. Last night, we talked to our contractor, and we decided to redo our kitchen. Our house is from 1926. And our contractor, who's a personal friend and has done really good work for us in the past, said, well, the longer you think and the longer you plan, the better off you are. So my first question is, what are some of the areas that we need to, what are the problem areas that we're going to run into that we should be aware of as we're looking at how do you start doing this stuff?
Sure. Let's pretend that the house isn't from 1926. Let's pretend it doesn't exist, all right? So the first thing we're going to think about is structure. You're probably going to want a nice island with a granite countertop. So what if your floor joists underneath that have too much deflection, that is bending in it, so that once you put the granite countertop in, the whole floor sinks towards the middle? So you're going to want to have your contractor run some figures so that we have a deflection that meets current code, or maybe even a little bit more. Now, what type of flooring are you putting in? If you're going to put in tile, especially you're putting in big tile, or if you're going to put in marble, you need to have a very stiff floor so that tile or marble doesn't bend. So we're going to start out with the structure. Number two, let's take a look at insulation. I assume that this kitchen has at least one, if not two, outside walls. So we're going to make sure we strip those walls, and we are probably going to use a spray foam insulation. You probably have 3.5-inch 2x4s. So we're going to spray it with urethane and get about R7 per inch. But then we have thermal bridging also. So the studs are going to be colder. So do we have enough room? We can put a 1/2-inch or 1-inch of foam on the inside to really make that wall efficient. And then where we've got the second floor sill boxes, assuming there's a second floor, we're going to have all kinds of air leaks. So we're going to spray foam those as well. So we've taken a look at structure. Now we've taken a look at insulation. And after that, it's all pretty simple. Plumbing, heating,
yeah,
electrical, and what you want it to look like. But 1926 houses, generally what's called the index of deflection, which is how bendy your floor is under load, was very different than it is today. Now, in theory, the city of Milwaukee would require that that floor, since you're touching it, meet current standards. But that may not happen. So decide to figure out what your cabinet plan is going to be, then talk to your contractor and say, do we have to double up these 2x8s or 2x10s or whatever down there so we don't have a bendy floor? And let's make sure when we insulate, this is really, really tight. We have to remember that a lot of our moisture comes out of kitchen if you cook the way my wife and I do. You know, making spaghetti by hand and stuff like that, there's a lot of moisture. So we don't want to get that condensation going into these old 1926 walls that have very limited insulation and no vapor barrier. So I would take a look at those things, insulation and structure, and go from there.
There you go, Barb. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck with that remodel. Appreciate it very much. I remember a friend telling me about his friend who had a lake home, and they decided to sell the home, but they wanted to remodel the kitchen. So he did it himself. It took him a year to remodel the kitchen on his own. And then they sold the house right away, and then they came back a few weeks later just to see the house, and it was flat to the ground. The purchasers just dropped the house to the ground and put up a new great big home. But that's probably not for you, Barb. That's not going to happen to you, Barb. Paul in Washington Island, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hello, PK here. I had just a note, especially for John, because I do deep energy retrofits on 1920 to 1870 homes, and it's really hard to find help that understands the builds of the old homes. So just a thought there, because they don't teach that in technical college, of course.
Yeah. How do people learn? They learn by probably working with guys like you, Paul, or you, John.
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem, is I really want to retire next year. I got one more house to do, and it's an easy one. It's going to be a 1950s home, but you know, I give the lectures every year at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. And I just think some young guy's going to come up and say, you know, you look old. Are you retiring? Can I have your business? But it never happened. It never happened.
Oh, man. Well, that is the problem.
And I'll just reiterate what Paul talked about, is sometimes when we have these 1926 homes, we really need to have an engineer take a look at it, because, you know, Barb's tearing out the kitchen, but if it's the second floor, maybe there's a big bedroom above that kitchen too. So not only do you need to do the kitchen floor, we might need to strengthen the bedroom floor. And then we take a look at the beam in the basement. Well, are the spans too big, so that when we get this heavy island, these new giant refrigerator, that we're going to have compression on the columns, or the beam's going to bend? So when I look at these things, I basically do structural calculations on the entire house and then make sure that it meets or exceeds the current code. And I can't tell you, Larry, how many houses I've walked in where they've got the beautiful 2-foot Italian clay tiles on the floor, and 30% of them are cracked because the floor is simply bending too much and the tile won't bend. So it really pays to do your research and to figure out your structures so that when you're done, you're actually done, and you're going to get 20 years use out of that kitchen.
I remember a basement that way of my current home. We dropped the basement floor by over 3 feet so that there was headroom down there, more headroom. And I thought it was going to be a relatively straightforward thing. But then we found out that our 1906 home didn't have any footings. We had to get an engineer in to do all the specs, and actually with quite a bit more money than I had originally thought it was going to be to get that basement floor lowered. But you need some expert sometime to.
That is correct.
You really do. Paul, thanks again. Gretchen in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Hi, Gretchen.
Hey there. Don't really know exactly what, I mean, the question is, I have water coming into my basement, and I last, a couple summers ago, I had some serious excavation done and a retaining wall that was explained to me, and this isn't about putting the contractor down, but it was explained to me this would help with that water situation. It did help in the very front. I have a exposed downstairs portion, and there was some coming in by the sliding door, but I'm still getting water in an area that I still did before. I would say it's probably less. When I talked to them about it, I mean, they did say, well, all the water's running down this way, and I said it was running down that way when we talked about it originally. The landscaping hasn't changed, so I'm like, I'm not sure what's different from you telling me that you thought, and you know, he's not a miracle worker. I think his intention was good, but
right.
I said, you know, it's still leaking, and I spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on that, and it's so infuriating because I'm still getting that water in, and when he did come back and I talked to him about it, and I said, well, the landscaping hasn't changed, so I'm sort of confused. But they did do, prior to that, they did do, I want to call it a dry creek, where they put a, they dug down and then they put whatever that would be, like drain tile and stuff in there. Now, I may not remembering all the vocabulary right. And then when he came back, he said, well, maybe we didn't dig that deep enough. But then now I've never really seen him again, and COVID hit, actually, so it might have been pre-COVID. He said, sure. I said, I thought you were getting close to the foundation to see if there were, when they pulled all that dirt away, and they said, well, then it became, they were concerned, because it is 1961, it's a house, but, you know, if the foundation got disrupted, there could be more problems. So I don't know. There's the start.
Yeah. Well, Gretchen, you live in a very complicated area, because east of your house, you've got those nice high bluffs that are rising up 200 feet, and you've got all this fractured sandstone. So I have a feeling that the person you hired probably calculated and figured out how to control the surface moisture. He didn't think about the subsurface moisture. We actually had a house on the east side of Madison, Larry, where they had a lot of problems, so we said, well, we are going to waterproof the entire foundation. So we dug around the entire foundation, and we found this 3-foot by 4-foot circle of sand. And when it rained, water shot out of there like a fire hose. It was basically a buried creek bed that was still draining half the neighborhood and was bringing tremendous quantities of water against the wall. And knowing Prairie du Chien as well as I do, and the fissures there in the soil, and the soil goes up and down and some places quite thin, it's entirely possible, Gretchen, that you have some subsoil issues. And unfortunately, what they probably should have done is dug all the way down to the footings, put a waterproofing on the walls, and then if they found something that was indicating high flow rather than just general permeation through the soil, done something to collect that water and relieve the pressure as well. So he may have looked at surface water and assumed that that was 90% of your problem, but it could be that 40 or 50% of your problem is actually subsurface flow.
Ooh. And so we're talking, to fix that, we're talking about what you were recommending?
Yes, unfortunately we are. And, of course, you can hire a geotechnical engineer for $20,000 to study it first, but I think I would just jump to the let's dig up the foundation, let's waterproof it, let's put in an oversized system. And if I knew exactly where Gretchen was in Prairie du Chien, I would probably have some. It depends upon how close to the river you are, how far you are from the bluffs, et cetera.
There you go, Gretchen. sorry for that news, but that's where we are right now with your situation. Thanks for calling. I want to give some others a chance to join in, but just a reminder, we're talking today with John Freiberger, Wisconsin home inspector with more than 40 years of home improvement experience, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement today with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online, so I think we will go back to the phones and to Tom in Black River Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I have a home, a farm home, story and a half, built in 1906. The basement is either sandstone or limestone, and I've got constantly have humidity problems, and I run a dehumidifier all the time, but it's still tough to keep it below 60.
Mm. Yep. That's, the problem with dehumidification is that you're drying out the air, and as soon as the air gets dry, more moisture comes right through those walls. So you're basically trying to dehumidify the soil around your house. And, Tom, there is no other real solution for that. The old walls are very permeable. They probably are limestone, but it's a very sandy limestone, so we call it sandstone. But they're very vapor permeable. If you put any kind of coating on it, it'll blow the coating right off. So you're best just leaving it alone. So I think what you're doing is probably makes the most sense, and going beyond that probably doesn't make any further difference. If you've got it down to 60% humidity and the basement is at 60 degrees during the winter, your dew point's going to be 45 degrees. So if you've got the sill boxes well insulated and preferably sealed as well, you really shouldn't have problems down there. The problem we get, Larry, with these really damp basements, if they get above the dew point, is we'll end up with aspergillus or stratibotra or other things growing on the wood, and we really don't want that because that becomes a health hazard. So I think, Tom, if you just keep working to try to keep it down to 60% in the summer and might drop to 50 in the winter, that's about the best you can do with the house that you have.
Yeah, there you go, Tom. Thank you. Marcella in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Marcella.
I have a one-story house, and had the roof replaced in 2019, and in the late November, snowing even. In the spring, the water was coming down the door frame in the hallway here, so I had to go up into the attic and check things out, and we put buckets up there, and I was handing them down to my husband to dump. But anyway, called the roofer back. He checked everything out and caulked it all up, and he said that this prefab chimney, stainless steel, should be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we'll have to do. I haven't been up there since last fall.
Sure.
And I don't know that it's leaking anymore, but he caulked up that chimney. He thought with the wind and the way rain was whipping in there, that was what was causing it.
Yeah. I've seen those, depending upon the style of the chimney, I've seen some of the older ones that had rain baffles on them, and they actually rusted out and corroded. Marcel, let me ask you a couple of quick questions here. So you've got this chimney in there because you've got, what, a furnace or a boiler attached to it plus a water heater, is that correct?
A water heater and the furnace.
And the furnace, okay. And how old is your furnace?
Furnace is out to the backyard.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The furnace was replaced. And that is an outlet to the backyard.
Oh, okay. So that is no longer part of the chimney.
Okay. So only the water heater is on this chimney now?
Right. And when I had that replaced, I wanted him to do it, but I don't know what happened there. It didn't happen.
Well, yeah, a side-vented water heater, and you could have simply gotten rid of the chimney, which would have been nice, because not only do you have water coming in when it rains hard or the wind blows, but you've got a lot of heat going out. So I would, our water heaters sometimes only last 8 years, sometimes they last 15 years, but sometimes it makes sense to prematurely change out the water heater, especially if your utility over there in Milwaukee might have some tax credits. A high-efficiency side-vented water heater is going to be 83-85% efficient. A plain old chimney-vented water heater, often 45-50% efficient. So you might be looking at a big decrease in your gas use for hot water. So I would talk to your utility, talk to a plumber, say, what would it cost to put in a side-vented water heater? And a side-vented heater is so efficient, it's vented through a piece of PVC pipe, plastic pipe, because it takes so much of the heat out of the fire that you don't need a stainless steel chimney. Then your roofer can come back and take that chimney down at least past the attic floor. Seal the hole in the attic floor so you don't have air coming up there. Seal the roof, and then you will have no more problems, no more handing buckets down.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Marcella, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. And Jim in Baraboo, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My question is regarding an LP tank. We switched providers the end of February, and the old provider has not come to pick up the tank yet. We've called a number of times, gone to the office, and we really want it out of the way because it's sitting right on the edge of the lawn, and we want to finish the landscaping and that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you have any suggestions on who to contact, what to do next.
No. Because the provider, your old Cenex Co-op or whoever, owns the tank, don't they?
Yes, they do.
My guess is that you can send them a registered letter and say it's got to be gone in 30 days or you're giving it away or something. But I think I would probably call an attorney first, since I'm not an attorney, and just say, look, I've got something here, and it's, you know, an attractive nuisance, or I don't know what it is. But basically, you got your property here. You need to get rid of it. It's going to be my property, and then I'm going to sell this tank to somebody. But check with an attorney and see how to handle that.
Yeah. Sounds like he's already made several efforts to work with the organization that owns it. So
I tell you though, a letter from an attorney, you look at the return. You know, you look at the return address and you go, oh dear. You know, it gets people's attention.
Yeah, it does, Jim. There you go, John in Shorewood. Your turn.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Just wanted to call and say great show, and I really appreciate the comments and listening to some of the info. I have a question about, it's a fairly new home. It's 04, and it's regarding electrical. I moved up from Illinois, and, you know, in the house there are several situations what I would deem to be in need of a GFI.
Mm-hmm.
Or GFCI.
Right.
And, you know, it's around the sink and this kind of thing. What is the code here, the local code? You know, for instance, there's a electrical outlet right next to a vanity, no GFI. Is it covered somehow with one in a nearby location or something? And then also, like, one outside, same situation.
Mm-hmm.
John, are you in the Shorewood, as in near in Madison?
No, Sherwood, excuse me.
Sherwood, okay.
Yeah.
Sherwood,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, John, what you can do is you can go to your local hardware store there, and for about $7 you can buy a GFCI tester. It has got two orange, one red light on it usually, or maybe it's the other way around. And get the one where it's got a little black button. You can actually short it out. Just because you got a GFCI doesn't mean the GFCI works. The new ones, when they fail, shut off. The old ones, when they fail, stay on. And you may find that they're in series. Like, you may find that your kitchen has one GFCI, but all of the outlets are protected. But the only way to know that is to plug in this little tester, press the black button, and listen for the pop. So go ahead and survey first. If you just simply go online to National Electrical Code, it will tell you. It'll tell you each year that they made the change. You know, it's like every 4 years, Larry, we add more GFCIs because it just saves a lot of lives. But do some testing first, so you know what you have, and then you can have the electrician come in, or you can put them in yourself. But again, if you put them in yourself, be sure you test them after you're done, so you know that's actually working.
John, thank you so much for calling. John in Rhinelander, do you have a quick question?
I do. I have, we have like 5 steps that lead up to the front door that are just full of ice, like all winter. We would like to put a foyer on it and connect the foyer to a detached garage that's just on a floating slab. I'm assuming I'm going to have to put a full foundation underneath that garage, and I'm wondering, first of all, is that correct?
Not necessarily. You're going to have problems with attachment because you can't attach something that's floating to something on a foundation. I would talk to a designer or an architect. What you may find is that you're able to use a pier-type foundation for this breezeway, which is going to save you a lot of money, and that they can put in some sort of slip joint so that the garage can move independent from the rest of it. So talk to a local contractor or a local architect and get a little bit of professional design advice about the various options for the foundation for that particular situation.
There you go, John. Thank you so much. John Freiberger, our guest today of Freiberger and Associates of Madison. He'll be with us right up to 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with John. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking home improvement questions on the show today with our guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. He's been with us for a long time. It's great to have him with us. And I should mention that, by way of full disclosure, John Freiberger Consulting is one of WPR's many business sponsors as well. So there's that, too. John in Rhinelander had a couple of questions for us as we broke for news, John Freiberger. So let's go to our John in Rhinelander again, who had another question. Hi, John.
Yeah, okay. So part of the addition, the breezeway kind of thing, would also include a new bathroom. So that's, I'm guessing, going to have a full foundation.
Yep, that will.
So, yeah, so then my question is, you know, to put a foundation underneath the garage, might it be smart to move it out of the way, underpin it, put a new foundation in, or just totally demolish the whole garage and start from scratch?
Well, it depends upon its condition, but generally you may find that you have new vistas in design opening up for you if you simply bulldoze it and start over. That may make a certain amount of sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. John in Duluth, Minnesota. We go to you next. Hi, John.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 40-gallon gas tank water heater that's about 14 years old, and we're thinking its life is going to be up any time now, and was thinking of possibly going with a heat pump electric water heater, but looking at my electric panel, it's a 1940s era house. There's a 100 amp service. The electric panel's pretty much filled up. I've got 3 circuits that are 220, 240 volts. Mm. And this heat pump water heater would require a 240.
Right.
So I'm thinking I'd have to upgrade probably a 200 amp service, and just wondering, you know, that's what kind of additional cost that would be to have somebody, have an electrician do that work in addition to the more expensive heat pump electric water heater. Mm-hmm. Versus just a replacement gas water heater.
Yeah, I think your assumption is indeed correct. And you're going to get more value out of that new breaker panel and the 200 amps. At some point, you know, you may want to remodel the kitchen. Of course, you're going to need 6 more circuits than you have now. So it's going to be a good investment. As to exactly how much it's going to cost, I have no idea what prices are up there. And I think the best thing to do is to call 2 or 3 local electricians and just find out what it is going to cost to put in the panel. If you need a new wire, that's going to be a new service wire. They'll be taken care of by the utility. A couple of other things to just think about, John, is I don't know whether your current service connector is probably overhead. So ask the utility whether you can get underground connector. I mean, you get ice and snow up in Duluth, and at some point, everything is going to be underground. So make some inquiries, and if we're modernizing this 1940s system, let's modernize it as much as we can with an underground service connector, a pedestal. Let's get rid of the overhead wires, get our new 200-amp service in there, and have better efficiency and have things that you're not going to have to touch for the next 25, 30 years.
Yeah, makes good sense to me. John, good luck. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Finally, have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Dave in Eau Claire. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. We've been living in our house for all 32 years. The house was built in the mid-80s. Got an 8-inch poured foundation. The basement has always been dry, even in severely wet years, years with great snows, so forth. This year, however, we've got water that's percolating up through the floor, through a location where they had a pipe coming from the well. They had, you know, it's about a 12 by 12 inch hole that just allows access for the well pipe to come through. Anyway, there is drain tile around the place. There's a sump in the basement, and it runs periodically. But this is the year that water has come up, the first year it's come up through the floor. And, boy, we've mopped up probably 100 gallons of water in the last week.
Oh,
wow.
What, can I just take some concrete, dig down through the dirt just a little bit and concrete that thing up and hope that it's going to just percolate out the drain tile?
Probably not. Now, Dave, do you think, is there an old well casing underneath that spot in the floor?
No.
You're sure?
Yep.
Okay, so this is just a water service connector coming from the outside well?
Yeah, it's a 3/4-inch copper pipe that came from the well casing. We had a pitless adapter put in about 20 years ago, and it previously had a Morrison head, and that's where the copper pipe came through. And they just abandoned it and re-piped in with some plastic. Anyway, that it never percolated through that hole before.
Right.
And even the year that we had 8 feet of snow, we had literally had water coming up almost to the house, and it never came in.
No, this is Dave. This is really a mystery. That pipe just shouldn't have water being pushed through it by hydrostatic head pressure. It's too small. So I can't really give you an answer on that. I guess the thing to do is probably open the floor, and then if there is water indeed coming through that pipe, is just to crimp it tightly, so no water can come through it, and then patch the floor.
Yeah.
But exactly how that pipe is getting pressurized and hydrated is a complete mystery.
Yeah. Sorry, we can't be of more help on that one, Dave, but appreciate your call. Jim in Brookfield, we go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My question is regarding a four-season sunroom that's attached to my house. It's about 20 years old, very well built, professionally installed, but I do lose heat through there during the winter cold, and I was wondering if you had an opinion on if that should be retained or remodeled or somehow sectioned off from the house so that I can better manage the heat.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming, Jim, you've got a lot of windows out there?
Yes.
Yeah, and what type of windows are they?
Well, they're put in by the Four Seasons sunroom people, so there's windows on the top and the curved glass that goes around to the vertical portion, but beyond that, I don't know.
I mean, are they a casement type, a jalousie type, a double hung type?
Casement.
They're casements. Okay, so they may be relatively efficient. The problem with windows is that what we have for windows in Wisconsin, what is we're required to have a U value of 0.27. And that basically is about an R3.5. Now, walls in our houses, I like to have R28. Most houses are at least R21. So basically, any window is sort of like having a hole in a wall. So if we're replacing windows, you're really going to want to look at good quality windows, something like a HS6, which is going to have a U value of 0.124. It's going to reduce your heat loss by half and also reduce your heat gain. So I would take a look at that. But while you're going to be doing a major remodeling, obviously. So depending upon what you've got for a thermal system, your walls, an insulation system, vapor barrier system, you're probably going to want to redo that as well. I would probably talk to someone who specializes in this sort of four-season sunroom. I mean, it's really not a four-season sunroom. It's really just a room, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we're using all year round. Because as energy prices keep increasing, you're going to end up paying more and more. So take a look. Talk to a sunroom designer, a contractor does sunroom, or talk to an architect and come up with a good plan and then see how much it's going to cost to implement it.
Yeah. There you go, Jim. Thank you for calling. Mary in the town of Lebanon, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question, I had a new toilet installed in a bathroom, and the plumber was not happy because the floor is not level. The house is built in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have somebody jack up the floors. It's only, I measured, it's about maybe a quarter of an inch off, and it's like the one contractor that's done work here, he says, there's no point in doing anything. Everything is very steady. I mean, the floors are very solid, so I don't know. Do you have somebody try to jack this up or not?
Well, if the stool isn't leaking and if it's not a problem, let's ignore it. At some point, Mary, you're probably going to do a complete bathroom remodel. You know, next year, 10 years from now, whenever. And then at that point, I tell people, if you're remodeling a bathroom, there's no such thing as remodeling a bathroom. You gut what's there, and you put in a total new bathroom with a level floor, with the correct load calculations, et cetera. So I would, at this point, as long as that stool isn't leaking, and with quarter inch, I'm sure he's probably got some shims under the part that's a little bit, with a hollow in the floor. So if that is working, yeah, he's unhappy. He's a little bit concerned about his warranty. You're going to call him and say, hey, the stool's leaking. Come back and fix this. But I don't think I would, at this point, tear up the floor just to do that. Wait until you're ready.
All right. There you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. Megan emailed to ask how to find good engineers and contractors. She'd like someone to check the structural soundness of her 1870 home, but the first contractor she used for another project when she bought the home in 2021 was a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
She's afraid to make the same mistake again. So how do you find a good engineer or contractor?
Well, yeah, finding a good contractor, it is so difficult. About all you can do is go on friends' recommendations. It does really help if you have a good plan. Because if you have a lousy plan, even a good contractor is going to have trouble doing it right. So you may want to either hire an architect who knows something about historic houses, or you want to find a professional engineer who is willing to work on old houses. They are sort of a specialty. I mean, there's a couple guys here in Madison that are very good at it. But if you just call... if you have PE behind your name, professional engineer, it could be you specialize in highway overpasses. That doesn't help you in an 1870s house. So unfortunately, it's a lot of calling around. Did Megan say where she lived?
She did not.
Okay. If we had an idea, that would help. Sometimes if you're some rural part of Wisconsin, I say talk to the local historic society. Maybe they had somebody who's helped with a house. If you're in Madison, you can talk to the State Historic Society. They may be able to give you some information. But do some investigation. Old houses are something that is very different. You need an engineer or an architect who actually knows something about them. Because a person is a professional, that helps. They've got a general education, even if they don't have a specific education.
Billy in Wautoma, it's your turn. Hi, Billy.
Hi, how are you guys doing? It's a great show again.
Thank you.
It's probably going to be a simple answer. I'm in a very old building, and they have what they called beaver channels in the basement, and it allows water to run through the basement. There's three of them down there. It's so weird down there that I don't go, and I've been wondering if I called somebody like American Water Works or Badger Basements or something, if it's even possible to waterproof something like that.
Do you have an idea of about how old the building is, Billy, and what type of foundation walls does it have?
Kind of a block. The building's real old. It was a general store, and that sort of thing. And it's probably at least 80 to 100 years old, I would think.
Okay. And it has a concrete block foundation, which are really, really difficult to deal with. Whatever you do, if it's going to be effective, it's going to cost a lot of money. So the question is, do you want to spend a lot of money, or are the little channels in the basement doing an adequate job of keeping the water away? I might just say go buy a good quality dehumidifier and leave it at that, one could put in tens of thousands of dollars, Billy, and still not have it perfect.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Diane in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to get some advice about my story and a half brick house.
Okay.
I've tried everything to keep it the upstairs cool in the summer, and it's always like an oven.
Yep.
Right now, I am getting a new roof.
Oh,
I
good.
Maybe something could be done there.
Yes. Okay. We started this program talking about outsolation and roof energy panels. So go online to GAF and take a look at the energy panels there. And look at the one that is a vented energy panel, because the problem is we have to have a vented energy panel to have a valid warranty on the shingles. And then talk to your roofer and see if they would be comfortable putting these panels over the top of the roof. The problem with story and a half houses is they're really complicated. Because you've got the second floor walls, the knee walls. You've got the ceiling above the first floor. Then you've got the attic above the second floor. Then you've got that little thin area where you've got 2x4 rafters that you just can't really insulate. So the idea of putting 3 or 4 inches of foam over the top of the existing roof in this panelized system is going to make all of those attic spaces, the area behind the walls and things, all part of the heated environment.
And that's going to
it's going to make a
problem.
Tremendous change in your house. There are ways of designing them so that you will never have an ice dam. Basically, Larry, it's like taking a styrofoam cooler and putting it over the top of your house. Your heat loss is so dramatically reduced. Your comfort level increases greatly. It is not cheap. And not all roofers know how to do it. Sometimes you have to talk to a general contractor or find a roofer that does know how to do it. But at least investigate. And I think just go to GAF, take a look at the panels. They're a major manufacturer. Their panels are good quality, as I said. So this is a product that was, to a certain extent, invented here in Wisconsin. And it was invented in Wisconsin because when we get to Cape Cod's and story and a half houses, they are just a bear to try to insulate,
yeah.
Especially when you're in these little tiny rafter spaces.
GAF. Diane, that's the place to look. I tell you what, we had a question from Steve He wonders if Renewal by Anderson Windows are really made by Anderson Window Company.
I have no idea. Again, Larry, it's buyer beware with windows. And I don't mean to cast any aspersions at Anderson or anybody else. But you need to know what your U value of are on your windows. Now, they're going to have a sticker on them. And if it says U.27, it's going to say energy code. Well, that's the worst window you can legally install in Wisconsin. I mean, that's what code is. Code is the absolute minimum standard. So if you're replacing windows in your house, you got to say to yourself, am I the kind of guy who would buy a Yugo? If so, U27 is okay. But otherwise, let's look at higher quality windows because utility bills are going up and up and up. And our windows are a big source of our heat loss. And if we can reduce our window heat loss by 50%, that can really pay for itself over the years.
And so what would you recommend?
I want something that is below a U.133. That is effectively an R value of 7.5. And that is better than twice as good as the 0.27s.
Oh, Hank called to recommend dehumidifiers from Thermastore out of Madison. He was able to get the humidity in his basement down from 60% to 40%. So mm-hmm. He likes the Thermastore.
Good product.
A good product. And there have been quite a few questions relating to that. So,
look at your energy ratings, because remember, you're going to be running this a lot, and you don't want to buy cheap and then spend a fortune on electricity. So go to good quality products. And, of course, Made in Wisconsin helps a lot. We have a tradition of good engineering here and a tradition of building stuff that works in Wisconsin.
Well, on that happy note, John, we are about out of time here.
It's been a pleasure. Great questions.
Yeah, some great questions as always, and thank you so much. And you'll be back in a couple of months, and we'll do this all over again.
I think I'm actually back in May.
Oh,
so
wonderful!
I'm going to see you in another 30 days.
All right, sounds wonderful. John Freiberger, our guest today, he owns Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg. And it's always great to have him come by. He's got lots of good answers for you and for me as well. Just looking ahead, we've got Garden Talk coming up tomorrow, and we're going to deal with turf and your lawn. Doug Soldat will be our guest today, our turf specialist, and I want to ask him, too, about professionals and how they care for those Brewers Stadium and all the other stadiums, and also golf courses, because the Masters Golf Tournament had some real issues. And it'll be fun to hear from him about that. And, of course, he'll take your questions as well. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.